This is the Tax Update Podcast for Saturday, May the 6th, 2006. This week, the $3,000 capital loss limitation in the AMT, a new tax court case. The Tax Update Podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the related document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use would include using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Limeburg Information Services offers email newsletters on various tax-related matters of interest to tax professionals, as well as access to a library of useful other information. Again, you can find out about their services at www.limeburgservices.com. This week, we consider the unfairness of taxes and the unfairness of things, or at least as viewed by many people who happen to get stuck in the dot-com crash. And the case this week we're going to look at is a recent tax court case that took a look at the interaction of the capital loss limitation and the basis adjustment on ISO shares. And this is the case of Merlo versus Commissioner 126 TC number 10. Now, this particular case, as I noted, is one that we saw arise quite a bit when the dot-com bubble burst in the year 2000. Let us go back to the heyday of the dot-coms and what was going on to set up basically the issue we have in this case. Any of you that had clients who were in the technology industries during that period may remember that the technology companies springing up during that time tended to not pay out their compensation in cash, but rather in stock options. In fact, options were the big thing because you would get the options, the value of the shares would go up, and then all of a sudden, you would turn around, you would sell your shares, and everything would be, you know, you turn around, you wouldn't sell, you'd exercise the shares, and then these shares would just keep going up in value, so you're up to get options. Many of those options were incentive stock options. Now, incentive stock options are granted special benefits under the tax code for regular tax purposes. That is, traditionally, when one receives a compensatory stock option from your employer, an option is not otherwise marketable, and generally they're not due to the restrictions, etc., that are imposed on the option. You recognize on the date you exercise the option income to the extent of the difference between the exercise price you are paying and the fair market value per share of the shares. However, if the option is structured to be an incentive stock option, then for regular tax purposes, you do not recognize that spread as income at that time. You can basically ignore that differential for tax purposes so long as you meet one of two holding periods. Those two holding periods are the 1 year from date of exercise holding period or 2 years from date of grant of the option holding period. You must hold on to the stock for basically the later of those two dates when you compute the dates. What that means is, by definition, you need to hold on to the shares for at least 1 year after you exercise them in order to get the regular tax benefits. And what you get at that point is, when you sell your shares, you now will get capital gain treatment on that spread, presuming the value of the shares have continued to increase. So we convert basically what would normally have been ordinary income into capital gain. Nice deal generally. Of course, it depends on a couple of things. Number one, that a year later that stock is still worth the amount of the spread. And number two, that you do finally sell the thing. You know, we get out from under this issue. So basically, we have those two items in play for regular tax purposes. Now, if that was it, if the shares went down in price, it would be sad, but not disastrous from a tax standpoint, because there'd be no tax benefit shown. These shares would be treated just as if they were shares that you had bought on the open market. So if I'd paid $9,000 for them and they were worth $1 million, and you may think that seems like very widespread, but as we'll find out in Merlo, we see such spreads. If you had basically exercise your shares are worth $1 million on the date you exercised, you then sold them a year later and they had dropped back to being only worth $9,000, You basically made an investment that stayed level from your standpoint because you put $9,000 out and you got $9,000 back when you sold. From tax standpoint, you have no gain loss. Hey, you look good. Now let's consider what would happen had those been non-qualified options. Well, in that case, if you'd actually held the shares, you would have recognized about $1 million of income when you basically exercised the shares. You'd have had to pay tax on that million, and then you'd essentially be in the same position as a person that had bought the shares for $1 million. So when they drop to 9,000, you basically are you're into a bit of a problem. You have a huge capital loss. Now, that becomes important because for alternative minimum tax purposes, essentially, we have an issue that arises. For AMT purposes, Section 56B3 of the code provides that incentive stock options, we essentially treat them for AMT purposes as if they were the run-of-the-mill standard non-qualified option. Therefore, that spread becomes part of the income. Section 56B3. Now, as we all know, a big problem with $1 million capital loss, we're going back to our person whose value of stock has declined dramatically, is that we have this little rule found in Section 1211B that imposes the $3,000 per year limit on capital loss deductions, net capital loss deductions on individuals. A taxpayer who has $1 million capital loss and doesn't have a source of a large offsetting capital gain at some point is going to be spending a long time getting back his capital loss at $3,000 a year. The question we ran into in Merlot was this. Presuming we have a taxpayer who faces that dramatic drop, when they sell, we are allowed under Code Sections 5556 an adjustment in our basis for the alternative minimum tax differential, basis differential in those shares, because Section 56B3 tells us in the last sentence of the section of the paragraph that the adjusted basis of any stock so acquired shall be determined on the basis of the treatment prescribed by this paragraph, that meaning presuming that we recognize the spread. Well, that differential now, let's go back to our fact pattern. We have $9,000 that we paid for the shares. The shares were worth $1 million when we exercised them. So that means for alternative minimum tax purposes, we have $1 million basis. For regular tax purposes, we have a $9,000 basis. The stock drops to $9,000 when we sell it more than a year later. At that point, for regular tax purposes, we have no gain or loss. For alternative minimum tax purposes, we have a $991,000 loss. The question becomes, are we only allowed to offset our AMT or reduce AMTI by $3,000, or do we get to offset alternative minimum taxable income, what I was referring to as AMTI, by the full $991,000 immediately, even though we have no other capital gains to recognize against that $991,000 loss? This is an issue that arose because of the structure of the alternative minimum tax. Remember, the theory was the AMT essentially changed the timing of income recognition in many cases. That's true of these options. If the value had continued to go up, we would have recognized the value of those options in the year we exercised. In the year when the regular tax then caught up and recognized that gain, the AMT would not. We're allowed, essentially, based on the structure of the minimum tax credit, to imperfectly recover that differential in the future. So we would compute a lower alternative minimum tax. When we compute the tax under the AMT system at the lower level, we would be able to net that against the regular tax, take that differential, use our credit against it, so that basically by having used that loss or used the extra basis, we would be able to recover some of the AMT we'd previously paid. Now, the $3,000 limitation comes into play because the question arises, if that applies for AMT purposes when we compute our alternative minimum taxable income, then this recovery is going to be a very slow one over a very, very long period of time. Well, let's look at the case of Mr. Merlot. Now, Mr. Merlot had these facts when he goes to look at it. Now, I should note that this case had been up before the court once before, where Mr. Merlot had attempted to argue that he really shouldn't have had to recognize the AMT income initially because he was subject to a substantial risk of forfeiture. That was his defense when a couple of things went wrong. Suppose we should set the background a little bit better here. Mr. Merlot had originally filed his return and had not claimed the full spread. Let's walk through his facts and we'll tell you what he had actually done. On December 21st of 2000, Mr. Merlot exercised an option to purchase over 45,000 shares of his employer's common stock at 20 cents a share. Now, on that date, these shares of stocks were trading for over $23 a share. Therefore, at the end of the day, he paid $9,225 to buy his shares. The shares had a total fair market value on that date of $1,075,289. Quite a spread. For regular tax purposes, a non-event. For AMT purposes, we have over $1 million of an addition at that point. Now, facts continue to go on for him. By April 15th of the following year, the due date for the tax return, remember, he had exercised his shares just before the end of 2000. So, essentially, 4 months later, or a little less than 4 months later, the stock price had dropped to less than half of its value on that date. Now, at that point, due to the dot-com burst, there was a lot of action in Congress where proposals were being floated around to try to solve this problem. And one of the proposals would have allowed the taxpayer to have only included the spread that existed on the due date for filing the return in question if that was lower than the spread on the date of exercise. Mr. Merlot filed his return on the basis of that proposed legislation. Nice try, but unfortunately, proposed legislation is not actual legislation, and at the end of the day, that proposed legislation never passed and never became law. So Mr. Merlot, basically the IRS examined his return, and they pumped that number up. At that point, he attempted to file an amended return claiming that due to restrictions imposed on the shares by him, that Section 83 prevented the amount from being taxable as income. We won't go into those facts except to just say that the tax court ruled against him on that point, but ruled that the other issue here that we're going to discuss, whether the 1211 limitation applies, was an issue that needed to go to trial. So that was pushed forward. We are now getting our decision on the $3,000 issue. But let's continue Mr. Merlot's story. Things may have been bad at April 15th for Mr. Merlot. The value of his shares had gone from $1 million to somewhere just over $400,000. Well, it got worse. By September of 2001, September 26th, the employer files for bankruptcy. So, essentially, about 9 months later, after he had exercised his shares, the company files for bankruptcy. 2 months after that, in November 21st, exactly 11 months after Mr. Merlot had exercised his shares and purchased his shares, the company announced the common stock had no value and Mr. Merlot's shares were worthless. Well, not good result. In one sense, out of pocket, Mr. Merlot was out $9,000. However, there was a significant income tax bill that was due on this capital, on this gain that he had supposedly incurred back in December for AMT purposes when he'd exercised. Well, realistically, at that point, he did have a gain. Because if you think about it, he had $1 million worth of value in his hands at that point. $1 million worth of wealth. Well, that wealth evaporated before December 21st of 2001 when he could have actually sold the shares and had them for capital gain purposes. Now, we don't get a full discussion here to be in the prior case, but I would note that there may very well have been a number of reasons why Mr. Merlot could not sell his shares immediately. But we'll skip that issue and go into the issue here moving forward, because we've all, I'm sure, had clients that went ahead and held them that could have sold and could have solved their issues, but didn't, and then had the problem arise. Now, Mr. Merlo is arguing that the $3,000 limitation should not apply to the basis adjustment triggered by Section 56(b)(3). And, on top of that, because this wouldn't do him much good if he just had this huge loss in 2001, it would probably wipe out his income and then the rest of the loss would just kind of disappear and go away, because if we're not catching it under the $3,000 in the carryovers, it would just disappear unless it could generate a minimum tax net operating loss. So he argued as well that it would generate an alternative minimum tax net operating loss. So Mr. Merlo's position was that the 56(b)(3) basis differential both skipped and should not be limited by Section 1211's $3,000 per year limitation, and as well should add to the alternative minimum tax net operating loss. Essentially, if you boil down his position on the two items, what he's really arguing is those two issues should apply only for the regular income tax and not for the computation of the tax under the alternative minimum tax system. So these two adjustments are gross adjustments to the amounts reported. And because they're gross adjustments, it also should not be considered like a capital loss for purposes of computing the alternative minimum tax net operating loss. So he should be able to carry back and recover his 2000 taxes, or a good portion of them, by generating this net operating loss, doing the carry back, and filing the claim for refund on that particular carry back. Now, the court's going to look first at the $3,000 limitation, because obviously if we solve that one, we pretty much can make the second issue moot if the court rules that the $3,000 limitation applies. Now, the court noted that this was a new issue. This really has not been addressed by the courts or directly by the code or regs. The court noted specifically the code doesn't address the issue of whether 1211 applies to the alternative minimum tax calculation. Sections 55 through 59 that deal with the AMT don't really discuss this issue of limitations like this. As well, there's no explicit regulation issued by the IRS that says that for AMT purposes, we go ahead and we pick up the capital loss, or we pick up the capital loss limitations, or we don't. The regs do not give us any real guidance on this specific situation. So the court said to resolve this matter, though, we think we have something that might help. And that is Regulation 1.55-1A. And that provides the general rule for computing alternative minimum taxable income. And that provides, to quote, except as otherwise provided by statute, regulations, or other published guidance issued by the commissioner, all Internal Revenue Code provisions that apply in determining the regular taxable income of a taxpayer also apply in determining the alternative minimum taxable income of the taxpayer. The tax court notes this is the broad application. So based on this provision, based on this regulation, if in fact we have a provision that applies for regular tax purposes and there's no contrary guidance found in the code, regs, or announcements, etc., from the IRS that tells us that this item does not apply in computing the AMTI, then the default is that it does apply. Based on that and the court's analysis that there is no other guidance on this issue, the court concluded that the $3,000 limitation of Section 1211B does apply for AMT purposes. The court concludes, everybody agrees this was a capital asset in Mr. Merlo's hands. Nobody has disputed that point. If it's a capital asset, then 1211B applies after we recalculate the basis. We apply 1211B because this regulation tells us that we apply the regular tax rules except to the extent that there's something contrary in the regulations or statutes. Now, what that means from a practical standpoint for Mr. Merlo is he has a lifetime $3,000 adjustment for alternative minimum tax purposes that's going to continue on for quite a while, presuming Mr. Merlo does not have $1 million capital gain somewhere he can trigger to create a differential that he could actually make use of for AMT purposes. And his AMT credit is likely going to continue on for quite a while as well, because he'll probably have no good way of recovering the AMT credit that he generated in the year of exercise. Now, the court went on and analyzed the AMT NOL issue as well, just in case something would ever come up on that matter. And the court concluded this is still a capital loss. And because it's a capital loss, it is excluded from computing the NOL deduction. And they note, under Section 7172, you find those rules and limitations that block the use of capital losses in the computation of a net operating loss for a taxpayer. So for AMT purposes, the alternative minimum tax NOL is the same as regular AOL, taking into account the adjustments. And the adjustments, the court holds, do not modify the exclusion. It's still a capital asset. Go back to our reg up above that we discussed earlier, and therefore, we find that we don't get an NOL from this loss carryover. I suppose that's good news or bad news for him now. If the NOL side of his analysis fell through, it probably clobbered most of his recovery anyway. The bad news is, without a significant capital gain going forward, Mr. Merlot is going to take a long time to make good. In fact, he'd better live an awfully long time to make good at $3,000 a year. Now, Mr. Merlot went on and argued a couple of other points. First, he said, this just isn't fair. That was essentially one of his key arguments. He said also that congressional intent for the AMT was not like this. Now, the court dealt with this congressional intent argument and said, you know, essentially, you referenced vaguely the Senate committee reports. From a practical matter, I think we would all agree that the way the AMT appears to have been designed, essentially, there should be a recovery mechanism to pick this up. But the fact that it sort of feels that way isn't good enough. The court did not find any specific discussion that they pointed out that suggested that the Senate really, 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 or the House and Senate really, really, really meant that these adjustments would bypass the limitations on capital losses or should bypass them. As well, the court has been very unlikely to impose a congressional intent override on a matter unless the statute itself is clearly vague and the statute is vague and the intent is clear. So there are multiple interpretations of the statute, and it is clear that Congress had one particular interpretation in mind when they passed it. Neither fact occurred in this case. So it's always kind of difficult to get the congressional intent business to stick, and in this case, impossible. On the issue of fairness, the tax court went to the I feel your pain position, meaning we really understand this is a terribly unfair result, but don't talk to us, talk to the Congress. And the court repeated what they had said in multiple cases involving the AMT and harsh circumstances, and there have been a number of harsh circumstance results from the AMT, that this is a matter that Congress must pick up. And as we've been aware, Congress has not exactly been on the ball picking up these problems. The AMT just doesn't really make their radar in terms of correcting these grossly unjust, or unjust, I should say, results that occur under the AMT, probably for two reasons. Number one, it's a difficult concept for many congressmen to get their arms around or have any clue and understand. Number two, because it's difficult for many congressmen to understand, their constituents generally who aren't impacted don't understand it. Therefore, it doesn't seem like doing anything about this is going to gather you many votes. And as we all know, in the political arena, gathering votes is important. Therefore, something that doesn't gather votes isn't generally going to be done. What are our lessons from the Menlo case? Well, first, until now, there were people who were trying to make this argument or who were taking the position. I had heard quite a bit of discussion from people who wanted to go with this position, that in fact, you could take that adjustment in the year of sale even if you went past the $3,000 limitation. Now, of course, Mr. Menlo went way past the $3,000 limitation, so his adjustment would stand out just a bit on his return. I would say it is going to be a difficult road to hoe to go forward on this position from here forward. The problem you've got now is you have a reported tax court decision. The IRS in exam is unlikely to give in on this position, and if you go back to tax court, you're most likely going to get the same result from the reported tax court position on this matter. Therefore, you're now looking at a taxpayer who wants to take this position is going to face a much more difficult fight to have the position go. Number two, I think the more important thing to learn is if you can avoid this situation with a taxpayer, it's important to try to avoid it. And there are some outs in the law that can help you. Unfortunately, they're imperfect. The biggest problem that we would find with Mr. Menlo's situation is the problem of exercising that close to the end of the year. Had Mr. Menlo exercised in 2001, basically had he waited 11 days, exercised in January of 2001, he could have made himself available of a relief provision. If you look at Section 56B3, Section 56B3 tells us that Section 422C2 shall apply in any case where the disposition and inclusion for purposes of this part are within the same taxable year, and such section shall not apply in any other case. What in the world is 422C2? Well, 422C2 is our relief provision, but it's an imperfect one. And you had the clue there in 56 that, in essence, in Code 56B, we were told it has to be the same taxable year that we both exercise and dispose. What 422C2 allows us to do is basically put our inclusion amount back down to the difference between what we exercise the stock for and what it's sold for. So we could bring our exclusion back down. In Mr. Menlo's case, we could get rid of the inclusion entirely if this had both occurred in the same year. If we do, basically, if we meet a couple of tests, there are two basic tests here. If you acquire the stock option through an incentive stock option A, and then number two, we have a disposition as a sale or exchange with respect to which a loss, if sustained, would be recognized to such individual. So if we exercise the shares and before December 31st we sell them, we don't have to recognize the spread as income for AMT purposes, Mr. Menlo's case, $1 million, and then recognize a short-term capital loss of $1 million, which we're not going to really get. What the law says is we can basically go back and treat the price on date of exercise as the price sold at. So in Mr. Menlo's case, since it would have been less than the price of exercise, Mr. Menlo would have had zero inclusion. However, once December 31st comes, we lose this break. Mr. Menlo exercised on December 21st. That means 10 days later, this safety valve gets broken. We can't make use of it any longer because from this point forward, his sale would occur in a different year. And in fact, that's essentially what happened in this case. He disposed of his shares in the year following. Now, this provision may not have been of any use to Mr. Menlo. As you remember, he did have that Section 83 argument that he had restrictions on his disposition. So as a practical matter, he may not have been in a position to make any use of this provision, at least unless the whole company had collapsed before 10 days were up after his exercise. However, in many cases, our clients can take advantage of this, but in many sad cases, especially in 2000, we saw taxpayers who could have made use of this and didn't, and then got nailed like Mr. Menlo when the company finally cratered entirely. I have actually used this provision on a couple of occasions with clients who were in technology companies that had the stock price drop dramatically. In both cases, we saw savings of well over $50,000 from the exercise, from the ability to make use of this provision to get rid of their alternative minimum tax gain. But in both cases, the exercise of the shares occurred early in the year, so we had a number of months to sit back and wait and see what was going to happen to the stock price. And when it became clear that stock price was going to be low, we went ahead and the taxpayer sold the shares before the end of the year. Now, there is a potential trip-up point on this sale. Note, 422C2B requires that the loss would be recognized except for that provision. What does that mean? What that means is you need to be very careful of the wash sale rules of Section 1091. If Section 1091 would have made the loss not deductible, then 422 arguably does not apply, and you now still have the full inclusion, and the basis of the shares gets moved over onto the shares that were sold or purchased during the wash sale period. Many taxpayers seem to have fouled up on this particular issue. There was a lot of discussion back in the dot bust day that, oh, you could sell the shares and just go buy new ones immediately, and that would save you, and then you could still sit on the shares. Because back in those days, a lot of people were convinced that while the value of their company had dropped dramatically, it was going to come back. So they didn't really want to get out of the company. So a number of advisors were suggesting, some in print, that you could just sell and repurchase, that they got the 422, but they didn't answer the question of whether C2B would trigger this under law under the wash sale rules. Now, it's not crystal clear the wash sale rules would come into play in this case, but I think it is very relatively, shall we say, clear. At least in my way of reading the code, I believe the wash sale rules are going to apply. If the wash sale rules apply, you cannot buy during the wash sale period, or you're going to blow the 422 safety valve and be right back where you were, especially when, as we found during those days, the stock continued to go downhill and, in fact, never recovered to the levels that it had been at when they had exercised. So what I suggest you do is remember these provisions and remember Mr. Menlo's little problem if you have clients who exercise ISOs. Now, the problem we don't see quite as often anymore because we don't have shares of stock going through the roof as we did back in the 90s, but these items go in cycles, and there will always be hot stocks, and there'll always be taxpayers who get into the hot stock situation and may find that their employer set up an ISO program. Therefore, you need to keep in the back of your mind the 422 issue. You also need to, therefore, keep in the back of your mind when advising a client that one of the issues to consider with the timing of exercising your options is that the later in the calendar year you exercise the option, the greater the risk you could be whipsawed by the rules if the price of the stock drops dramatically. As I tell my clients, all things considered, I would prefer that you exercise an ISO very early in the year, simply because that gives us the most maneuvering time. Now, economics and reality may dictate you're going to exercise at a different time, but if you do, realize that once December 31st goes by, you are exposed. Whatever tax is due, and if the stock price were to tank after that, you might not be able to recover or even sell the shares for the amount of tax you're going to end up owing. Clearly, in this case, Mr. Menlo did not sell his shares, could not sell his shares for the tax that was due because the value of his shares was zero. I tell the clients, you understand that risk. If you're willing to take it, that's fine, but you need to make your decision by December 31st. It's also a very good example for clients of the importance of keeping in touch with your tax professional during the tax year. I tell all of my clients that I can do much more for you before December 31st than I can ever do for you after December 31st. Once December 31st rolls by, what can be done goes down to very little, and now we're looking at straight mechanical compliance issues. It is much easier to arrange your affairs ahead of time so the compliance issues become obvious than to attempt to take your situation and now hopefully try to find a rule that's going to apply to what exactly happened that somehow will make things good for your situation. That's especially true in a case like this where the law provides a remedy, but the remedy requires very specific action. Now, this has been the tax update for Saturday, May the 6th, 2006. As noted before, the tax update is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, found on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Again, you can visit Steve's site at that address to find out about all the services that he offers and all the newsletters that he publishes on the various tax-related topics. This has been the tax update for Saturday, May the 6th, 2006. The theme music is from podcastthemes.com.